Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
French elections are hotly contested. Apple's volatility is spiking, and lots of breakouts and breakdowns. All this and lots more on episode 260 for April 24th, 2012 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, thanks for joining me today. This is Andrew Horowitz, and we do have a lot to share with you and to go over because it is the middle of earnings season. It is the high time of economics. And of course, our guest today, as I may have told you a couple of weeks ago, we were going to get him back, is Das, the author of Extreme Money and an all-time favorite of the show and our listeners. Every time we have Das on, man, I get more emails saying that guy is awesome. And I tend to agree. So we're going to hook up with him in a little while. He's down under in Australia. We'll bring him on and ask him lots of questions. He wrote a great piece recently on China, and I want to talk to him about that as well as his thoughts on what's going on in Europe. And we talked about a couple of things over the last few weeks here in my office. One of the things was concerning was, hey, what's going to happen with the French election? Because it looked like Sarkozy was starting to lose a little ground. And in fact, we're seeing that that is the case over the weekend, where Sarkozy is trailing by a few percentage points by Holland. I think that's how you say his name. And it looks like that the tide is turning on the acceptance of what they did in the ECB with the bailouts and the various situations there. And if you look at the track record of Sarkozy under his rule, the state-owned companies and the companies that are French-based have done horribly, absolutely horribly compared to the ones that are not owned by the state. And that has a lot to do with the reforms they put in, the lack of firing, the lack of structural changes that were allowed to the benefits programs, the inability for those companies to do what they can to shrink expenses, et cetera. And that was all a sign that, you know, his regime is not, or his government, has not been liked very well. So what we're seeing is the aftermath of all the various stimulus programs, the austerity programs, the bailouts, and now the people are revolting. So we're going to see what happens over the next few weeks with the changes that are looking like they're going to happen there. And we'll have to pay close attention to it because this is going to be a big issue, it seems, with the whole ECB and what's happening. Don't forget that France and Germany were really the linchpin of all of the bailouts and the things that went on with the ECB. These were the two strong countries. And again, France is looking like there could be some additional downgrades coming due to their banking situation and the amount of bailouts. We also saw that the ECB put about $200 billion up, and another combination or a combination of that, another $230 billion went to the IMF for additional backstopping of the European area. That happened on Friday. Markets didn't really react too well to it. I mean, it's kind of wondering, well, if you need another $430 billion in the stockpile, how bad is the situation there? And we saw that the Spanish bond auction really didn't go as well as could have been expected. Rates were higher than were expected, and we know that the ECB is purchasing a lot of bonds there. I thought we'd talk a little bit about Apple briefly. You know, we've kind of gone back and forth on what's going on there, but basically there's something wrong there, and that may not be anything more than just a little bit of concern ahead of the Tuesday night earnings that'll be happening next week. And we did see a couple of news items and some reviews and, you know, what's going on. Well, it seems like Qualcomm and other vendors that do supplies for Apple didn't have great quarters, at least the quarters that everybody expected. So they reported, and that had an effect on Apple, because what happens is that if the suppliers aren't doing as well as could be expected, is Apple really selling as many of their devices as people expect them to be? Meanwhile, we have $1,000 and $1,001 price targets on them, and only one firm, if maybe two, a smaller firm, downgraded the stock just to a notch last week, but yet we're seeing 4% swings in Apple's share value on a regular basis, and that's not great. We took our position down for our client portfolio some time ago to like a 1.2, 1.3% position of Apple, took out most of the profits that we had, most of the gains, and actually added back to it on Friday when it was about 572. So we'll see what happens moving forward. I do think there's going to be a lot more volatility there, and at the same time, still have a lot of faith in Apple as a company, but the charts are breaking down pretty ugly right there. The other thing is, I don't know if you noticed, our market trend indicator and everything that we're seeing here from a volume standpoint and from a overall market trend direction is in a strong downtrend. But at the same time, with earnings season here, we're seeing a lot of companies breaking out and doing some strange things and at the same time breaking down. There's been a change of complexion of the markets recently. What we saw in the first quarter was that if companies missed on earnings, it was kind of put aside and stocks were taken up and maybe reversed higher. Well, the reverse is happening right now. We saw companies like, for example, Alcoa move higher, then down a bit. We saw Bank of America initially move up, then down about 7% from where they were. Goldman Sachs beat, but it's coming down. We're short of Goldman Sachs, by the way. Tempur-Pedic finally broke down. The mattress company was down about 21% on Friday after their earnings outlook disappointed. He's talking about VMware. VMware spiked up but came down again. Riverbed, boy, yuck. Oof. It was down about 30% or 28, 29% on Friday after they disappointed on their outlook. And we have a couple of other biggies happening. A lot of things happening next week. The earnings reports are going to be rolling in fast and furious. Buffalo Wild Wings is starting to break down. It is just on the edge of breaking down. And we put out an alert on that on Trigger Point Research last week. And we'll see what happens when they report. They've been a stellar performer, but there is a very large area of no support underneath about 25 cents from where we are right now. Take a look at the chart. We also put that on Trigger Point Research. I want you to check that out as well. That was one of the most recent alerts. Just click on the top where it says recent alerts, or on the right-hand side, it'll say Buffalo Wild Wings, and there should be some information there. But we have some things that I also want you to pay attention to, because Tuesday is an important day. We have the Case-Shiller numbers coming out on the year-over-year 20 index of houses, and a lot of people are saying that, well, we've seen the bottom in the housing market. Really? How do you call a bottom if you don't have any stabilization? I guess it is possible that with all of the recent buying in Florida and some of the areas that were hardest hit, that maybe there'll be some price appreciation. We saw some there, but is it going to show up overall? That's the big question. We also have the consumer confidence number coming out on Tuesday, which is from the conference board. Wednesday, we have Bernanke speaking and having an FOMC rate decision. Those are often days of very high volatility. The last Tuesday of the month, I mentioned this last month, is often a turning point day. Looking at the trend that we had, it's usually a breakdown. And when that happened last month, actually, it's the end of the month. You have window dressing going on. You have chasing of performance towards the end of the month. You have moving out of positions that they moved into due to the third Friday options expiration, which was on Friday, big volume there. And, you know, you just got to pay attention to a reversal potential. I know it's kind of strange, but that Tuesday seems to be a big day for that. So watch what happens on Tuesday. We are on the verge of a market breaking down here. We're right below the 50-day moving average, which has been a line in the sand, a big fighting zone for the S&P 500. And we reversed lower 2 days in a row, which really gives you, you know, a question as to what's happening with the institutions right now. If the Fed doesn't have any more stimulus, and if there is going to be a withdrawal of this, you know, as we call it, the heroin of the financial markets, you know, what's going to happen? I think that right now we're seeing a big change in the dynamic of investments. And while we're seeing a lot of companies, as a matter of fact, about 70% of the S&P 500 companies that reported so far have beaten, it's really, you have to look at this in what did they beat? What did they beat? They beat lower expectations. Severely lowered expectations. And it seems to me that the run-up that the stock market had in the first quarter, actually we'll go back to December or so, into December and into January, February, was really more than should have been, considering the fact that we're only seeing about a 5%, maybe a 5% increase in EPS and pretty much flat revenue period over the quarter a year ago. And what that shows me is that there was a lot of optimism out there, a lot of chasing just to get returns, and that kind of move will be retracted if the stocks don't really do have a stellar blowouts overall. And right now we're seeing a lot of signs of that. Now, I'm not suggesting we're going to absolute spiral down or anything of that nature, but we are hedged pretty well right now, and it's paid off pretty well. Our portfolios are doing very nicely this month. Markets are down, on the other hand. And, you know, that's because of the fact that there's a lot of turmoil, again, that's cropping up in Europe. And at the same time, you're seeing that earnings are questionable. The bank earnings are still reliant on strange accounting. They brought in a new accounting procedure this quarter to make it look like things were really in great shape. And at the same time, you know, everybody's worrying about the financial cliff, the fiscal cliff that's going to be happening at the end of 2012, where there's going to be an automatic reversal of the Bush tax cuts, which would be terrible. So there's a lot to think about with what's going on right now and the timing of the market positioning right now. And I think the biggest issue right now you really have to look at is the trend. And the trend is not, well, let me back up. In 2011, we saw trends break down and then turn around in 2 days. That hasn't been the case recently. We saw a nice upward slope of the markets and very low volatility. VIX came down under 15 for a little while. The question is going to be, is this whole financial mess over with yet? Already, Prime Minister Wen said just this weekend that he doesn't think so, and they're going to maintain very strict policy. A lot of concern about what's going on in China, the slowdown there, the stockpiles of goods and the lack of demand from Europe, and their GDP slowing down and their manufacturing slowing down. Same thing's happening here. Inventories are rising and manufacturing has been slowing. Consumers still seem to be okay with it, but consumers are fickle. Let's remember that. So I think that right now you have to respect the fact that the trend is showing a lot of distribution and you're seeing a lot of changes in the dynamic of how markets are reacting. The movements are a lot wider for individual stocks and the markets. And you're also seeing a lot of the more defensive positions holding up and the growth positions or the more risk-on, quote-unquote, positions selling off. And this is why you want to be where you want to be especially careful with your levels of where I'm going to put that stop in. I'm not going to hold and hope. Do not do that. If a stock moves against you and it's moving down and it's moving below the area that there is support, you know, you got to get out. You could always get back in. Do not be afraid to get back in. I want you to get through your head right now. I want you to think about this. It's okay to get out, and it's okay to get back in. It's okay to go short. It's okay to cover. It's okay to reshort if it's going back in the direction that you think it's going to. I'll give you an example. Last week, we had a decision that Sina, S-I-N-A, was actually a candidate that looked like it was going to actually start moving lower. It was very weak. It was moving below some very key trigger levels that we have, and we said, you know what? This, if everything is lining up here, we're going to go short. Well, the stock went down about 2% that day, and the next day it kind of held. The next day it was up 2.5%. We reshorted into it. It ended up the day down. The next day it was up 1.5%. It ended the day down again. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen and spiral down. But what it does show you is there's a lot of weakness and distribution going on. And if the markets hit a real distribution patch, you have to watch these growth plays and either hedge out by using puts or maybe a few of the inverse ETFs, or start looking at trimming down your positions to a much lower size, taking some profits if there are some, and it's okay to take a loss. Sometimes they say the first loss is the best loss. So you don't get involved in, you know, hoping and praying that it comes back up. And at the same time, when you see a stock is basing out and you find that level that is important and it may bounce up, take a position, a small position, and then build on it. That's exactly what we did with Silicon Motion. We had that as a portfolio. We also sent alerts out on that. We picked it up in the 18s. It went up to 22. We said, you know what? This is the high point. We took out some of the position, and it came down a bit. It was up 10% on Thursday. We took out part of the position on Thursday, and on Friday it was down about 4.5%. But still, it was up. I mean, it's up tremendously from where it bounced. It's okay to do that. You have to be in the game in order to win, whether it's on the short side or the long side. Just remember that. Discipline and being in the game, right? You can't just sit it out unless, of course, things are just so crazy like they were back in 2007, 2008, 2009 that it just doesn't make any sense to do anything because things are so chaotic. Anyway, lots to think about what's going on right now. I want to mention that, of course, this episode is also sponsored by GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting, great service. I love GoToMeeting, you know, because you can actually be able to, I guess the newest part of it that I like is you'd be able to attach a face to a name with this HD faces that they have. And the nice thing also is you get a 30-day free trial. I'll tell you how to get that in a second. And it's by Citrix, you know them. It's all you need is a webcam, and you can click to collaborate with a group or an individual. You can work with a team, family, friends, whatever you want. Share what you have on your screen. Have a meeting from anywhere in the world instantly. Very, very easy. You can start hosting your own face-to-face online meetings today with GoToMeeting, free for 30 days, by going to GoToMeeting.com, clicking on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code podcast. Make sure to use that promo code podcast to get 30 days of free, absolutely no strings attached, free use of GoToMeeting.com and their new HD faces, part of their process and program. Really cool stuff. I like it a lot. And then I just want to mention to you that if you haven't checked it out, Trigger Point Research, we sent out a lot of alerts last week to members. And if you haven't had the opportunity to check it out, if you're looking to trade and get some reasonable levels of entry and some guidance in terms of, okay, where would be the point of breakout, breakdown, triggerpointresearch.com, you should really just check it out. I think you really like what you'll see over there. And there's no trials available right now, but you know, it's $99 a month for the breaking up or the breaking down. We also have Latin America that came on board with Colombia stocks. We have Mexico, Brazil, and Chile coming on soon. And right now, we are covering all the S&P 500, major Momo stocks, and some of the small caps as well in the U.S. And you need to really see what's going on because our performance on the daily and weekly and monthly has been pretty cool. We have some reports that are going up. By the time you listen to this, you'll see that. TriggerPointResearch.com. Let's get to our guest, Das, why don't we? And as I say, always backed by popular demand, our good friend Das, who is the author of Extreme Money, all the way from down under in Australia. He is going to talk to us, hopefully today, and clear up some things when it comes to the areas of world finance, credit, and some of the things that are going on that may be under the surface that we really don't see because we are also just bombarded with the news that seems to be very slanted in a few different ways. Also, I'll mention that we're going to get to some of your questions that you had put on Twitter. I asked you to do me a favor, give me some questions you have for Das, and many of you did, and we picked out a few of them that would be interesting. So, Das, how you doing?
I'm good, and you?
I am pretty good, thank you. No complaints here. I can't believe it's the end of April already.
Look, this year will be gone, and more money will be made and lost before we know it.
Yeah, it may have been happened already, just as we just said that.
Absolutely.
So hopefully all things are going well with you. You sent me a really intriguing piece, which was all about China. I really want to kind of dig into some of that, and I want to talk to you about some of the issues about Europe. But one of the things I guess we'll start with is this whole idea of China, because it's become a very... Although I think I will say this, it's become very important in of late, and there's like all eyes on it, but it seems to be the effects of some of the things that are going on there are less important from a global market perspective these days. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I think people have started to focus more on what I would call the autarkic world. I think people are now looking at every country almost on its own, because the assumption now is that there is no global solution. So basically, people are focusing on individual conditions. And I mean, I hear this all the time about the United States, is ignoring Europe, ignoring the emerging markets, the U.S. is going to do well, which up to a point I think is fairly valid, but it's also a little silly because the interconnections that we had previously haven't gone away. They're still there.
Right.
They will affect
you. I always say globalization that was talked about by Jim Rogers over the years, right? The great globalization is a blessing.
And Thomas Friedman. Don't forget Thomas Friedman.
Okay, Thomas Friedman. Is a blessing and a curse.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll give you some an impression of how China is going to actually affect this sort of dynamic. Because I think what's happening in China and the debate about the hard and soft landing will continue for years. But I think the interesting thing is where this effect will be felt of China's slowdown is in a couple of areas, one of which I think is in all the commodity-rich countries like Canada, in Australia, in South Africa, in Brazil, because they have built their entire economic growth stories around this massive importation of raw materials into China. And that's not going to happen. I mean, to give you some idea, the Chinese stockpiles of copper are now about 3 million tons. And they're not going to just keep buying if their economy slows. So, in fact, what you're going to see is this perverse thing that China's dynamic is going to go on and they're going to slow, but you're going to get these exaggerated moves in other markets.
Well, but, you know, for those of us who can't envision that many millions of pounds of something, what kind of an inventory backlog is that with their annual consumption rate of copper?
Well, to give you some idea, for the rest of this year, if they consumed at the same level last year, they'd only consume 1.7 million tons. Hmm. So they've basically got roughly about a little more than a year's supply.
Hmm.
And normally they would have less than that. They would have like 2-3 months.
Right.
So they've got like 4-5 times. And that's just only in copper. There's rumors around that there are similar sort of inventory backlogs and things like aluminium for some reason.
Aluminium?
Yeah.
Like aluminum that we say it here.
Absolutely. You Americans say aluminum.
Aluminium. So, all right. So let's kind of think about there's also this piece that you wrote. I want to kind of I circled a few things. This is something that you wrote recently, and it's called "All Feasts Must Come to an End: China's Economic Outlook." And I kind of want to go. Firstly, the first area in the beginning in the preamble, you say China's economic structure is deeply flawed and fragile. Why don't you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Okay, I think the first thing is I think you've got to look at China before the crisis and China after the crisis. Before the crisis, they had what I would call a Japanese model and a German model, which is they used exports, particularly to the strongly growing developed world, to propel the domestic economy. And obviously in 2007, 2008, when you got the simultaneous recession and slowdown in its major trading partners, they panicked. They had 20 to 25 million people unemployed in the province of Guangdong alone. And as you know, social stability and political control is very important to the Chinese. So basically, they realized they had to do something. And what they then did was switch to what I call the American model. And the American model meant, let's use debt to basically fuel the domestic economy. And the way they did that is very different to the way, say, the Europeans or the Americans did, where the governments ran up massive deficits. In China, they did run a deficit, but it wasn't very big. But the Chinese control their banks, because they have majority stakes in the four major, what are known as the policy banks. These are people like Bank of China, the ICBC, the CDB, and all of these people. And they encourage these people, and in China, encouragement means you do, these banks to lend. And they lend massive amounts of money. Well, if you don't lend, you just end up before a firing squad.
Right, exactly. That's really, you will lend, please.
That's right. You will lend, and they do that. There are very funny stories in China from friends of mine where, you know, I know one guy, who obviously I can't name, but he said that he borrowed X amount from the bank. I said, do you need the money? He said, no. I said, well, why did you do it? He said, that's a very silly question.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But basically, that money went into mainly what's called the state-owned enterprises, which is government businesses. And they then had to use the money. And what they did was basically build these massive expansion of infrastructure, which is they have more airports than they know what to do with, and the very fast train projects. There are roads. I mean, there are more 4- and 8-lane highways in China than you could imagine, bridges over rivers. And, you know, in Japan, they talk about bridges and roads to nowhere. Well, China's pretty much the same. And that was designed to just employ people. Now, there's nothing wrong with infrastructure. But the problem with that infrastructure is that in the previous cycles, when they had these, and they've done this before, by the way, they did this in the 90s as well. And when this happens, is you've got to grow into the infrastructure. And the problem is, I'm not sure they'll be able to do that. So it'll set off two problems. The one that Jim Chanos sort of hyperventilates about, which is it set off massive bubbles in certain areas like property. And the concern is that that will deflate with fairly severe consequences. My personal view is there are going to be bad debts in banks, but they're not going to be that severe. And the reason is pretty simple. They don't actually, certainly in the property market, they don't lend aggressively. The loan-to-value ratios are low. And the Chinese generally have large deposits. And to some extent, the people who buy property in China are fairly well off because you have to. To buy them, and they're all related to the party in some way, the Chinese Communist Party. And to some extent, the Communist Party will not sort of allow the property bubbles to deflate in a way which is catastrophic. But the bigger problem for them is actually loans to local governments, which pretty much the center tries to control but can't. And what the Chinese did was very interesting. In February this year, people forget, the Chinese government gave this rather interesting instruction to all the banks to roll over about $1.7 trillion, that's 25% of their GDP budget, of all loans to the local governments for 5 years. And there was all sorts of, you know, face-saving words about you have to make sure the loans can be paid back, but everybody knew every loan had to be rolled over. So they're just going to keep these bad debts rolling. And if you actually look at China's balance sheet very carefully, you'll see that from the previous rounds of these, there's about 300, 400 billion of what are known as asset management companies with all these bad debts from previous episodes still sitting there. So what that will do is that'll suck up a lot of domestic savings in China, and basically it'll be unproductive. But the real problem is that most of these new projects are going to have very low rates of return. Now, think of a company or a country as being very similar. A country is just a series of projects. And in China, investment is around about 50, 55% of GDP. And if that doesn't actually earn anything significant, well, your growth's going to come down. And I think that's the biggest problem that China has. And that problem is going to slowly sort of manifest itself. And I think China's desperately now hoping that they can somehow find a solution, and they can't. And you can see the magic signal that they can't in a perverse way. As you know, last year, they were trying desperately to slow this lending binge, which is, lending is running at 30 to 40% of GDP each year. Mm. They're growing the lending by, which is astonishing in any shape or form. But last year, they got very scared about this, and they started to try to rein in the lending. But then the economy starts to slow. And now this year, they're trying to rev up lending. And one thing that it comes down to is I have a simple measure. Everybody tells me China's growing at 8 to 10%, and I say, that's fantastic, it's great. But to generate that growth, you need to pump in, say, somewhere between 30 to 40% of GDP in loans. And we all know a portion of that loans, be it 10%, be it 15%, be it 20%, is actually not going to come back or not be productive. So let's say the loans are 40%, and let's say something like 10% of those loans, which is 4% of GDP, is bad. Shouldn't I be deducting it from the growth of 8 to 10% as bad debts? And in that case, their growth halves. So I don't think China's growth is actually that real. It's kind of a fictitious growth. And people have to understand that. And I don't think people necessarily have focused on that.
Well, there's two things that come to mind with that. First of all, it seems like the state asset funds that you say is very similar to a Maiden Lane Holdings.
Oh, it's absolutely identical. Yeah. They have lovely names. My favorite one was one from about 5 or 6, 7 years ago. It was called Hurong, which means divine wind.
Yeah.
And I loved it because it was full of wind.
Yeah, full of wind from the wrong place.
That's right.
And divine gassy wind. Now, here's the thing.
That's right.
The other thing is, so what you're saying to me is, what you started the conversation was, is that they were using a model based on Japanese and German types of economics to try to moderate and to manage an economy. And they switched over to an American-based one, which then, therefore, is funky accounting, hiding a shell game, hiding bad debt, rolling things over, kicking the can down the road. It seems like actually the whole world has switched to that because it's worked for us for a while, and so far so good. But you really have to wonder when, you know, the piper has to be paid. Is there ever a day? Is there something that's going to happen that everybody's going to wake up and say, hey, you know what, we can't do this? Or are we just going to be in this process of devaluing our dollar to basically eat up all the debt?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in what you're saying. The first thing is the only way you can deal with this problem is by kicking it down the road. So I have some sympathy, strangely enough, for policymakers. People say they're kicking the can down the road, and I'm saying, yep, they are. But if you look at the other options, they're not particularly palatable either. Mm-hmm. And certainly from a political point of view, they're unpalatable. So, you know, I don't actually endorse the policies, but I know why they're doing it.
Right.
The next thing is, well, how do you then try to sort of keep the game going for as long as possible? And the only way you can do that is this term, which has now come into the financial lexicon, financial repression. And let me give you an example of how China is going to deal with the problem, certainly domestically. Now, in the case of Chinese domestic savers, as you know, the Chinese save an enormous amount. They save between 25 and 35% of what they earn, which is extraordinary in a poor country. Because remember, the average income there is something like 20% of what average income in the States is, for instance. But the point is, how do they deploy that? Now, in China, there's really only two options. There's property and there's the bank deposits, because the equity markets are quite small. So basically what they do is they put their money in banks, and the banks are controlled by the state. But the point is that they get negative returns on it. So they get interest rates, but the interest rates are below the rate of inflation. And essentially what happens is that they are actually subsidizing the banks, which in turn are subsidizing the borrowers. And because they're getting paid somewhere around 3 to 6% below the inflation rate, you're basically robbing the savers to keep the game going. And as long as they're willing to accept that, which they have been for 30 years, and that's a huge transfer, it's about 5% of GDP each year, that transfer, you can keep the game going for a very long period of time. But it's not actually ever going to resolve the problem. It's just going to keep the thing. The best way to think about it, it becomes just a chronic illness rather than a life-threatening situation.
So therefore, if this is the case and these keep on, you know, the same situation keeps on happening and the rolling over, the kicking the can down the road, and is what I'm to take away from this that the net effect on this will be that GDP growth will slow over time because they can't put that much money into the system and it kind of starts mounting slowly, and that, you know, it will be sometime in the future that this has to be reckoned with, but, you know, that's kind of like, well, politically that's fine because I don't have to do it on my watch.
Exactly, and this is exactly what's happened in Japan. If you actually look at this scenario that we're seeing, despite the fact of particularly Chairman Ben Bernanke and everybody else saying we're not turning Japanese, we are turning Japanese.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Japan did. And the problem here in doing that is Japan started the game with some huge advantages. The first advantage was they had the world's largest savings pool domestically. The second advantage they had is while they were doing this famous word deleveraging, the beauty was their private sector had no debt. So it's particularly the household sector, the corporates did. The corporates reduced debt, the government increased debt, because government at the start had low debt. The other thing is, while this was happening in Japan, the rest of the world was growing, so their export industries could create a buffer against this. And the last thing is the Japanese are a very homogeneous, very, very cohesive, and very stoic society, which basically took the loss of living standards in Japan fairly calmly. Now, my question is, will the rest of the world share those same criteria? And I think really what has happened, and it goes back to your question, how long can you do this? It's not really an economic question. It's really a political and social question. And if you look at Europe, for instance, you're starting to see that fray. I'll give you two or three examples. I mean, people always look at the Greeks rioting in Sigma Square, which is fine. But you look at the subtle things that are going on in places like Spain and Italy now, where the two governments agreed with the European Union to cut their budget deficit, then quite blithely say, well, we're not going to do it for a couple of years. And they're not doing it because for any other reason than, A, they can't actually mechanically achieve that. But the union in both countries have put enormous pressure on the governments to say, if you do this, you know, firstly, the country will collapse, which it will, but more importantly, we will bring the country to its knees. So there'll be different ways that these pressures manifest themselves, not necessarily economically, but they will manifest themselves in terms of the political and social pressures. And I think that's one of the biggest things that will drive volatility in markets now.
Well, one of the big things is that there's a difference, right? The difference is that in Greece and in Spain and U.S., when there are riots, when there are protests, when there are, you know, people packing together trying to make a statement, well, they kind of do it, and it gets sometimes a little bit rowdy and all that. The other side is Tiananmen Square. And,
exactly.
You know, when you have a situation where there's an uprising in many of these communist Asian countries, it doesn't last very long.
No, and this is the fascinating thing. This risk of the political side is actually very interesting in China, because most people will have been aware of the internal intrigues in China going on, which is the sacking of Bo Xilai, who was one of the princelings. Now, the interesting thing about that is from time to time, there are these sort of ritual executions, which are very reminiscent of all communist regimes from Stalin.
You got to have fun somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, an occasional shooting does provide entertainment value to the population. Besides, it keeps everybody else in line.
Right.
And essentially, but there is now underlying that a huge debate within China between the modernizers, which are represented by the existing government, and the likely successor to Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao. But also the Bo Zhilai's sin was he was associated with the far left, which actually wants a reversal of some of the market reforms and so forth. And that tension, I don't think, has gone away. In China, nothing ever goes away. It sort of simmers under the surface for a while and then pops up from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I read a lot of the China Watchers, which are kind of weird because they all sort of have prognostications for politics. And I suspect unless you're inside the Chinese Communist Party, it's pretty difficult to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, they don't have a clear view on how this is going to resolve. And I think the West is fascinating. I read things like the FT and the Wall Street Journal. They're now reading into China what they want to read into China. They see this sort of tide of liberalization as being inevitable, and I read that as being the West desperately needs China to liberalize, to open up its economies, so we think that's going to happen. Whether that actually happens is a completely different question.
Yeah.
I think that's very dangerous.
Well, you know, you have a lot of different things in here about the ghost cities and that you know, we're looking at about 60 million empty apartments, which is extrapolated from the fact you look at the electricity usage. You know, there's a lot of things in here that are pretty spooky-dooky. And, you know, you talk about that there is going to be a problem, but you don't think it's going to be based on the housing per se, which is, again, the Chanos directive. But I guess, quickly, can you really trust the Chinese data?
No.
Okay, that's good.
It's very difficult. But I think the things that I look at is actually things outside of China. And there are two stats I'll give you, which is quite fascinating. One is I look at the shipments of commodities into China. That's much more interesting. And often I look at people, I know quite a few people who organize trade fairs, because the way Chinese sell is all the exporters come along to a trade fair and all the buyers turn up. And this occurs at regular intervals through the year. And, you know, I know people who run those things. And you get it's not accurate, it's anecdotal, but you get an idea of how much activity there is going on in that sense. That's quite useful. The other thing is, interestingly enough, the China loan growth stats are pretty good because the Chinese banking authorities have a better stat system than, say, for the overall economy. Because, you know, you've got four large banks which contribute probably 80 or 90% of the volume, so it's very easy to get.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I look at, which is actually quite perverse, is people who sell goods into China. And the fascinating thing is people who are selling goods into China are pointing to slowdown, things like machine tool manufacturers and so forth. The only thing in China which just continues to sell really well are luxury goods.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, actually. Yeah, that you know, a lot of people have asked me over the years, last couple of years, who's buying Tiffany? Who's buying Gucci? You know, who's buying all Michael Kors? I said, well, take a look at what's happening in Asia. Really, that's where they're being targeted. I mean, look at the, you know, Starbucks is hitting them hard right now with their new Verissimo machine. And, you know, the biggest buyers of the silver and diamonds and all that is all throughout Asia.
It's interesting. And the reason is actually goes back to the way, particularly let's take China, China's organized. China's organization is like a feudal kingdom. The Communist Party is the ruling dynasty. And the ruling dynasty has a bunch of people out there and they have to control them. What they do is they encourage a group of princelings for different reasons. These might be entrepreneurs or these might be people who are connected to the party or descendants of, you know, revered figures from the revolution, and they allow them to get enormously rich. It's like a buffer between you and the rest of the people. It's a model which is 10% run the country, then they basically encourage 20% to get reasonably rich as a buffer between them and to control the other 70%. That's how it works. And that 20% is extraordinary. I'll give you an interesting story. I go to Beijing not that frequently, but frequently enough to know this. And I used to stay at a hotel called the Kerry Center Hotel, and it's got a very famous jazz club. And my amusement on Friday and Saturday nights was to actually sit outside the hotel and just count the number of expensive cars and sort of do a back-of-the-envelope calculation of what the value of the cars were. There would be Hummers, there would be Maybaches, there would be Ferraris, there would be Maseratis, there'd be Lotus Esprits. And on an average night, you'd get something like $40, $50 million worth of motor vehicles just coming in to drop people off. Hmm. And this is in a country where the average income is around $6,000. And it's quite extraordinary.
So the good news is that if I ever have to entertain you, it's going to be a cheap night out.
It's going to be a very cheap night. All you have to do is get me a seat outside the jazz club, sitting in the street, counting the cars.
You know, it's interesting because
a beer would be nice.
there's been some discussion recently about who's buying what. It's a lot of very wealthy Chinese women, young people, buying the most expensive cars that are out there. There's new cars coming out. They're $400,000-$500,000. They're buying like crazy over there. But that's another discussion. Let's get to some of the Twitter discussion questions that we had, and maybe cover some of that. And I want to kind of circle back to some of the things that are going on in Europe. There was a Twitter question. He says, "How does Das stay so informed on a daily basis? Like, what's your routine? What do you do?"
I basically spend 6 to 8 hours of the day going through data and reading every piece of information in the countries that I'm interested in. So it's a very rigorous routine. It takes about 40 hours a week.
And you're just kind of just consuming and putting the things down and from various news sources and
news sources, and also I obviously read all the research that comes out, but I tend to go to the hard data. I don't really like reading economic commentary because it's somebody's view of what the data means. I prefer to read the data.
And
I often actually don't read financial sources. I tend to read newspapers in terms of other pages of the newspaper, if you like, because they sometimes tell you more about what's going on than probably the data. But, you know, just tell your Twitterer that the basic thing is I'm a lifelong nerd, an idiot, and haven't got a life. So that's basically...
We figured that out from the car discussion. We got that.
That's very true. Very true.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned about the news and all that, because I've been having a little friendly argument, debate, spat with some of the folks over at Bloomberg. There's one particular guy, and I know who wrote the article by the headline, because it is constantly about when China misses an economic number or when there is something negative that happens in China, or even when positive, the article talks about more reason to look for stimulus. It's all about the stimulus, stimulus, stimulus. I mean, I am sick and tired of the news media. I don't know, why are they hanging their hats so closely on this whole idea of stimulus constantly?
You know, there was a guy, a Czech guy, during the communist period, who said something which is just so true. He said that you in the West assume the media is free and therefore believe it. We in the East, which was a communist East in that stage, know that it's all propaganda. So we've learned to look behind that, find out what the information that we really need is. I think anybody who assumes that news in the West at the moment, financial or otherwise, is anything other than propaganda is kind of delusional, because I just don't think it is. And I'll give you a very, very interesting view on that. I was trying to get an opinion piece published, and it was quite amusing to see some of the discussions around it. The level of self-censorship at some of these news outlets was quite amazing. Oh, we can't say that, we'll offend these people. Oh, we can't say that because we'll offend this individual. We can't say that because it doesn't tie up with our leader writer and so forth. So there's a lot of self-censorship going on. So I think you've got to be really careful not to actually start with the premise that this is believable. Yeah. I don't think it is.
You know, I have friends that actually are not invited back to various news, particularly in TV, because they don't toe the party line.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, at a very minor level, if you're an analyst and you ask awkward questions at a briefing by a company, you know, they won't stop you coming in because that's too obvious. But what they will do you is give you a seat behind a pillar when you could be waving your hands as much as you like and nobody will ever see you. It's very easy.
Yep.
It's very, very easy. And you know who started that, don't you? It was Jack Welch. It was Jack Welch. Jack Welch basically very much screened the analysts that he actually favored in terms of information.
Yeah.
That was how it worked.
I wouldn't doubt it. All right, another tweet came in. It says, what alternatives, this is kind of a big one, what alternatives are there to austerity in Europe?
Well, I think fundamentally, let's go back to the basics. What do they have to do? They have to basically reduce the debt and try to get credit back. That's pretty straightforward. And I think in the end, the way to do it is to write off large chunks of the debt, because what they're trying to do is reduce the debt through austerity, which is essentially, you know, save up to pay back the debt. But in saving up, you just basically kill growth and the economy. So my view is they're going to have to write it off, and which means inflicting a lot of pain on basically the savers. And this has really got to do with the north-south transfer. The northern countries have lent the southern countries, so if there's a write-off, the northern countries basically reduce the actual investments they have. And that's what's got to happen, because this is all this talk about Eurozone bonds and so on is rubbish, because the best way to achieve that is just write down the debt. And that would give these economies a chance of growing, because the debt burden is lower, so you don't have the debt overhang, and you don't have the servicing costs of the debt. So you can stimulate the economies and basically try and grow, and it's pretty difficult.
But isn't that at the expense of the northern countries?
Yes. We all know somebody's got to lose. I mean, Andrew, you and I have been around this game for a long time. If you've made a bad loan, you're going to have to write it off. It's just a question of when.
Right.
Yeah, unless the tooth fairy comes along.
But here's the deal. Nobody wants anybody to lose.
Exactly.
That's
and you can't
the problem.
Have that.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing that you're going to have to do is basically devalue to get some export competitiveness. And to do that, that means killing Germany. Because just think about a euro without all the Mediterranean countries. It's not going to be at 130. It's going to be at 180 or 2.
Right.
Which means Germany dies. So basically the way you correct this is to write off the debt, and you basically kill Germany, is the best way to describe
it. And a lot of people wouldn't care about that, right? No.
Well, there are certain people who would take
Germany,
that too, but I don't think Germans necessarily take
no,
that.
No, Germany comes out this week with a great, real happy-pappy level of confidence. And you got to wonder, how is that possible? What are they confident about? I mean, all right, the LTRO, you know, you pump in $1 trillion. Okay, that's great. So that makes me happier. Banks are not failing right now. But then you have this whole Spanish thing, which was always there, by the way. And 25% unemployment rate, 50% unemployed under the age of 25. There's nothing going on there. Real estate that's in a disaster zone. Banks that are in horrible shape. The only reason why they're even in existence is because they were flushed with money recently. I mean, what is there to be happy about there?
Well, that's not in Spain, but in Germany, you've got to understand a couple of things. One is, we're talking about the press. The German press disclosure of the risks of Germany, of the bailouts and what's happening in Europe, is shocking. I have a friend who's German, and he reads, obviously, the German newspapers, and he's just absolutely staggered at the lack of disclosure. The German politicians, led by Chancellor Angela Merkel, have not really told the German people what's going on. There's very poor reporting. That's number one. They don't know. The second thing is their immediate experience is of low unemployment. And basically, they have jobs. They have dollars in their pockets. Things look good. So basically, that's the first thing. And the third thing is, how can you trust any country which basically likes umpapa bands?
Oh.
In terms of making...
Yeah.
In terms of that. So whether they're happy or not is kind of odd in that way.
And you know what? You got to throw in a country that does the polka too. That you got to not trust them so well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think that's all well and good, but the reality is in Europe, the inevitability of the steps that we were just talking about is just there, and it's not going to go away.
Yeah.
It's just not going to go away, and all we're doing is a slow dance of death to that inevitable conclusion. The problem is, if we had taken the measures needed 2 years ago, which has made Greece default, probably made Ireland default, made Portugal default, written off all the debt, it would have been small potatoes. It would have terrified the Spanish and the Italians and the lenders to them to force these disciplines through, and you could have muddled this through.
Yeah.
But now the problem is so big that basically it's just impossible. I mean, the absurdity in Europe can be summed up by two things. The LTRO, which is the long-term refinancing option, which I actually now refer to as the Lourdes treatment and resuscitation option.
Yeah, that's right.
And basically, that is weak banks being given money by a central bank, and the weak banks then lending it to a weak sovereign, who, by the way, is backstopping the central bank and the weak banks.
And
I mean, how that actually works
is mind-boggling. Who thought of this? This is like, you know, this is like, I don't even know, but it is the ultimate in super leverage.
Absolutely. And, you know, and then you have the European Central Bank, whose balance sheet is $3 trillion, and the entire Eurozone central banks have a capital base of 80 billion. So that's leveraged about 40 times. So, you know, you remember we used to joke, you and I, about the European Financial Stability Fund being the world's largest CDO. Now we can joke about the fact that the ECB is the world's largest leveraged distressed debt hedge fund.
Which is basically what it is. Which, by the way, they said they would never do.
Exactly. And that's what they've done.
Yeah.
And then you look at the other absurdity is now people, I noticed The Economist had this week an article about that it's inevitable that you're going to get Eurozone bonds, which is about mutualization of debt. And I said, this is like two drowning people clutching each other in the hope of salvation.
Exactly.
And it's how's that going to help?
And not only that, Germany's not going to go along with that because it would sink them.
Well, exactly. Well, the point about here is that I know that all of us are into brotherhood and helping our fellow man until our own lives are threatened, at which point brotherhood and all of those concepts somehow become secondary. And I think that that moment will come for Germany. Certainly it's come for France. Let's be very clear about that, that downgrading and the problems they're having. And France is now desperately trying to sort of get out of the Merkozy partnership, and then you know, it's quite amusing to see Sarkozy talking about the need for growth and everything else when he was spouting austerity as recently as 4 or 5 months ago.
Yeah. All right. The final question, and again, we'll make this quick because I want to talk about a few other things. What, from your side of the pond, so to speak, what this is from Twitter. What is? Let's see. What was this? What is the opinion, or not even opinion? What does the rest of the world see the Fed as, and the view of the Fed from the rest of the world?
Well, I think the view of the Fed is that the Fed have got two strategies, which is extremely clear, that they're going to keep monetizing debt. So that's absolutely clear to the rest of the world, and they expect them to keep doing that simply because they can. And it solves two problems for them. One, it solves the problem of financing this large federal deficit, because the U.S. is going to run a $1 trillion deficit for the foreseeable future. So basically, it's got to be financed. And people forget that the Fed bought 70% all government bonds in 2010 and 61% in 2011.
Nice,
so
guys.
Nice. You know, it's like basically selling bonds to yourself, but that's neither here nor there. And so they see that as being the case, and they understand that what Bernanke is going to do is essentially reduce the debt effectively by knowing that he's got these captive holders like the Chinese, the Japanese, the Middle Eastern countries, who really basically are trapped now because they can't do anything. And he's going to devalue the dollar and devalue the value of the purchasing power of the dollars. And basically, he's going to reduce that $3 or $4 trillion that's held in this way as far as possible. So, in fact, the rest of the world sees Bernanke, as long as you don't hold these bonds, by the way, if you hold these bonds, you don't share that view, see that as an extremely logical way of doing it. But the smarter people in the rest of the world see this as extremely destructive to international cooperation and the entire global financial and economic system, because it's basically going to destroy all trust between people.
Yeah. You know, I just thought of an analogy I think that's really appropriate to explain the monetization of the debt and what the Fed is doing by buying bonds. It's kind of like me putting an iPhone on eBay for sale at $10, okay, and having a reserve, and opening up another user account and bidding it up and then buying it myself.
That's exactly what he's doing.
I mean, that's what it is, right?
That's exactly what he's doing. Yep. There's no difference between that. Yep. And you get the artificial feeling that everything is good because the price of your iPhone is not 10, it's $200.
Yeah, how great is that?
Exactly. Everybody says, look, these things are valuable.
Isn't that what happened this past week with Spain? With their bond auctions, there was such BS that their bond auctions went off at a much higher rate. They got, I don't know if it's good, but they got a good bid to cover. They got it was about $17 billion in total, I think it was, that they got off. But it was the ECB buying a lot of it, right? Whatever was left over.
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, I think people are a little bit naive if they think that all the central banks, the ECB and all the politicians, don't talk about this. Everybody in the world was looking at these auctions. So what do you think the conversation between the ECB's open market desk and all the other central banks
was? Oh, it's very clear. It was simply make it fill.
Absolutely. And I'll be honest with you, the ECB open market desk are a little bit naive. So they actually rang up market participants and they actually asked what sort of bid to cover ratio would be good for confidence.
Yeah.
They actually rang up.
Yeah. So listen, so we have the markets are getting a little wonky here, and we have this kind of risk on, risk off thing, and you know, all this is going on because there's a lot of uncertainty. The economic surprise indicators that I follow in the U.S. and around the world are really starting to slope down. China, the GDP comes down. Unemployment is good here from a percentage basis, but yet now we're starting to see changes, manufacturing slowing down, inventories are building. India is whatever's going on over India. And in England, they say they're not going to do any more stimulus. In Brazil, they're slowing down and having to possibly pump money in. And by the way, have you been getting the trigger alerts and the reports I've been sending, right?
Yes, I have. I have been. I've been reading them with interest.
So, you know, the whole point is that, you know, what do we do in that kind of environment? I mean, I feel like we're going back to, you know, 2011 in a way, where there was this all of a sudden change in the sentiment, this constant, you know, moving in and out. And, you know, how do we then gauge what to do?
I think the trigger level reports are kind of useful. And let me explain why. It's like, I think there are normal environments in financial markets when you look at those wonderful things like cash flows and companies right. and underlying things like that. And the macroeconomics is important, but it's kind of a background because you always assume the economy is going to grow more or less. It's going to have a few rocky months here, but the good months are going to outweigh the bad months. But now you've got this strange world, which is driven by, number one, policy actions.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, people's reading of those policy actions. And so essentially you're going to get this very choppy ride. And to a large extent, you're looking for a bunch of information in a digestible form, which gives you some key things you want to focus on, because we're now inundated with data. Mm-hmm. We're just absolutely inundated with data. Right. So the trigger analysis does fill that role to some degree. And, you know, you can supplement that when you want to with other pieces of information. But it's a good place to start the way of thinking about it, because I think that risk on, risk off world is here. Actually, it's interesting. HSBC actually published two things in their quant research, which I was looking at, which were quite interesting. They've created this index of what they call the RORO, the risk on, risk off. And now, look, the index, like all indexes, is a bit misleading. But the most interesting thing is, if you look at it from about about 2000 onwards, and it's basically the risk on, risk off trading has doubled volatility.
Hmm.
It's roughly doubled volatility, and that's quite significant. And the other thing that it showed is they did an analysis of the correlation between different asset classes, and they did this wonderful heat map where red was obviously highly correlated, and basically green and yellow was low correlations. And the graph, say, in 2005, looked a fairly lush field. There was lots of greens and yellows, just the odd red.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did it in 2012 in April, it was more red than anything else,
right.
Which makes it really hard to trade these types of markets.
Well, it's all futures based. It's all futures based. A lot of this, and it's all big movement one direction or the other. Not always, but it's, you know, it does have that criteria these days.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that these movements are very choppy. They're very large, and the other thing, as you say, is they're very short term. Nobody holds anything for very long now, and that makes something which you can immediately visualize, which gives you a bit of information,
yeah.
Quite useful.
Yeah, everybody's, you know, I tell you, the alerts, they're really loving the alerts. I got to tell you something, I'm getting emails all the time, which is really cool. But we'll talk about that offline another time. I'll tell you what's going on with that and the reports that we have, this really cool thing we have going on there. And commodities now, all of a sudden, we're seemingly putting up. But let me kind of just, we'll close this and on a couple of points here. There is this feeling I have, from the way the U.S. markets have been acting. The first quarter was just out of control with, out of nowhere, money coming in. Is it possible, in your opinion, that there is a feeling out there that the U.S. is the best house on the block, and let's just kind of start liquefying and liquidating money from around the world and at any given time just shove it over into the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. Now, people often forget that you actually are not necessarily looking at the world in absolute terms, looking at it in relative terms. And I've been joking the last 6 months that the best thing that the U.S. has going for it is that its name starts with U, not E, and it's America, not Europe.
Right.
That's basically the thing it's got going for
right.
it. And I think that's very, very important. The other thing, other than the fact that it's a relative world, not an absolute world, that you've got to be very careful to understand, is the way investment managers are structured. Investment management mandates are very limiting. You might be, let's say you run a portfolio of financials, So you've got to be 90% invested in financials, 10% maximum cash. And you've got to be in financials. And you don't want to touch European financials. So what do?
Right. You have no choice.
So you've got to buy American ones.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the way the ebb and flow of what's going on, it appears that way. And it looks like, you know, at the end of the day, everything's going to come back to the U.S. and it may go filter out again and then come back to the U.S.
Well, actually, I think you've got to look at the U.S. in two ways. The real economy has a lot of issues. We all know that. The employment numbers are not as good, you know, the budget deficit problems, the debt problems, all that. But it's more manageable in the U.S. because they've got control of the currency. They've got basically ability to trap people, the foreign investors, into basically losing money. And that all works very, very well. works pretty well.
Uh-huh.
And that's very powerful. So that actually, in the real economy, there are ways to sort of muddle through. But the point is, in the financial markets, the dynamic is slightly, separate from the real economy because of this fact of where are you going to put your money?
Right.
And sort of putting it under your bed. And everybody talks about, let's put it into gold. But there's limits to how much you can put into gold or other things. And, you know, people just can't buy copper. Where are you going to put the bloody copper is the question.
Well, so, yeah. And now that, you know, the ETFs have been another reason I think that we have this volatility.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they're talking about they haven't done with is an aluminium ETF these days. You know, and that would obviously boost that.
In the aluminum.
Aluminum, yeah. Oh, that's what
in the
saying.
Aluminum.
Yeah, aluminum. They're talking about doing that. And that's just going to, you know, prop up artificial, assuming it's going to be backed by the physical. But
yeah.
that's going to prop up the, you know, the artificial nature of a lot of this. And then, you know, my concern with gold is that what happens when gold comes down to a point and there's real liquidation of it, and
yeah.
they really do have to sell it, and, you know, you have all these funds out there that are going to be, you know, on the future side, they'll be selling it, and then all of a sudden they have to liquefy the gold itself, and then it could really get a little ugly.
I think all markets, particularly new markets, when things are moving up, look very sound and sensible. You have to test them on a few downturns to see whether they can actually survive that. And until you do that, it's very difficult to know whether the model is sustainable or not. And I think that's the big problem with ETFs. We haven't.
It's like a plane. You could fly a plane just fine, but put a few clouds in the way and it gets a little bumpy.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a wonderful website, by the way, which the Australian airline Qantas effectively pilots run. And there's a line in that which I always remember. The definition of a successful pilot is one whose landings, the number of landings, equals the number of takeoffs.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate you spending some time with us. Das, he is the author of Extreme Money. He is a wonderful guest, your favorite, as chosen by you at the beginning of the end of last year, I guess it was. And, you know, we'll get you back on because I want to talk about some of these things that you're looking at. I do want to also eventually talk about the whole Japanese situation and how it's possible that they're actually giving money to anyone after they basically are sucking up all the money that they have and throwing it through their system, and that the crazy idea that they're all excited about a 1% inflation rate that they may have this year.
It's wonderful. You know, you talk about the relative world. Excitement in Japan is growth, which is barely above zero, and inflation of 1%.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a weird, weird world.
It's
that's
a weird,
all we could talk
I hear
about.
You. All right, Das, thanks
for joining. As always, good to be with
You're
you, and good luck with your trading.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. That's going to wrap it up for this episode. Please do me a favor and have a good week and pay attention to the markets, the market trend. Don't fight the trend. And we'll see you next week with some great guests. Anything you'd like to ask me, please do so at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you next week. Have a profitable one.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.